Hello, everyone. Dan Delman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. And today's first item is something I read in the New York Times several weeks ago. And it's entitled, "The U.S. Isn't Made for Functioning Human Bodies." And what this refers to, actually, is infrastructure, or to be more specific, public toilets. So hang on, I'm going to tell you a little bit about that. Here's a popular slogan for President Biden's infrastructure plan: pee for free. Sure, we need investments to rebuild the bridges and the highways and the electrical grids. But perhaps America's most disgraceful infrastructural failing is its lack of public toilets. If you think back, the Greek and the Roman period, there were public toilets. That's 2,000 years ago. If people sitting on benches with holes to take care of business. There were no partitions, and the Romans had means of taking care of themselves afterward by passing the, I guess you'd call it, the community sponge on sticks around the room. However, try not to be put off by that. I'm not endorsing that arrangement for the United States, but at least the ancient Romans operated large numbers of public latrines, which is a lot more that can be said of the United States. The humorist Art Buchwald once recounted an increasingly desperate search for a toilet in Manhattan. He was turned down at an office building, a bookstore, and a hotel. So he finally rushed into a bar and asked for a drink. "What kind of drink?" the bartender replied. "Who cares?" Buchwald said. "Where's the men's room?" America should be better than that. Japan manages what may be the world's most civilized public toilets. Ubiquitous, clean, reliably equipped with paper. In almost every industrialized country, is more bladder friendly than the United States. Even poorer countries like China and India manage networks of public latrines. But the United States is simply not made for people who pee. "I go between cars or in the bushes," said Max McIntyre, who has been homeless for about 10 years. As he told about standing outside the tent where he lives in Manhattan. "And sometimes at my age, if your body says you gotta go, then you gotta go." Well, most stores and businesses are of little help, as we know, because they often insist on a purchase to use the restroom. And that's even before a pandemic closed down many shops. Cities also lose their livability, and open defecation becomes a threat to the public health. Americans have painstakingly built new norms about dog owners picking up after their pets, but we've gone backward with human waste. Meanwhile, it's not just the homeless people who suffer, but taxi drivers, delivery people, tourists, and others are out and about trying to navigate the landscape that seems oblivious to the most basic of our needs. The same is true of parents who are out with their kids. How do you take care of your kids if they have to go? Where do you go? Maybe if you're close to a Walmart or some other large grocery store, they'll have a room available for at least for mothers and their small children. But we have very little to accommodate the average person. What's a parent supposed to do when a toddler needs to go? And what about people with medical conditions that require more frequent urination or defecation? Why do we make life so difficult and humiliating for them? How is it that we can afford aircraft carriers, but we can't afford public toilets? For men, it's more convenient to disappear behind a trash can. But men also face a greater risk of being arrested. And the consequences can be dire. At last count, 13 states sometimes classify people arrested for public urination. They classify them as sex offenders. Hardly seems fair. Toilets then are an infrastructural item and very much an important issue as we look to repair the country. But it's more than that. Bathrooms are a humanitarian issue. In the 19th century, the United States set up public toilets in many cities, and they were often called public urinals, abbreviated as PU. This may be part of the origin of PU to mean something that stinks, although there are competing theories. In the early 20th century, these were supplemented by comfort stations for men and women, but most closed in waves of cost cutting over the years as urban areas had budgetary issues. That's partly because this is a class issue. Power brokers who decide on infrastructure decide on the priorities, and they can find a restaurant to duck into. Well, that's less true, let's say, of a black teenage boy, and utterly untrue of an unwashed homeless person with a shopping cart. Granted, operating toilets is tough. American cities have experimented with various approaches to providing public restrooms, and they've found that they are costly to maintain and sometimes attract drug traffic and prostitution. Still, though, no one would build a home today without a bathroom, even though it adds to the expense. So why do we economize and accept cities without lavatories? If the Romans could figure out 2,000 years ago how to do this, why can't we? Are you concerned about your privacy? Well, Americans have become inured to the relentless collection of their personal information online. Imagine, for example, if getting your suit pressed at the dry cleaners automatically and permanently signed you up to have scores of inferences about you. Measurements, gender, race, language, fabric preferences, credit card type. That all shared with retailers, cleaning product advertisers, and hundreds of other dry cleaners who themselves had arrangements to share that data with others. Might give you pause. But that's the daily reality on the internet. Every minute a person spends online helps countless companies build a thicker dossier about that person. Despite what corporations profess, much of this personal data is used not to improve products themselves, but to make those products more attractive to advertisers. One straightforward solution is to let people opt in to data collection on apps and websites. Today, with few exceptions, loads of personal data are collected automatically by default unless consumers take action to opt out of the practice, which in most cases requires dropping the service entirely. Virginia recently had the opportunity to extend firmer data protection rights to its residents, but the state's Consumer Data Protection Act, signed into law recently, is a business-friendly package, and it's supported by Amazon and Microsoft. It puts the onus on consumers to opt out of most data collection, except for the most sensitive personal details. Washington state lawmakers are advancing similar legislation. Corporations say opt-out provisions put control into the hands of consumers. But users are no more likely to switch off data collection than they are to read through the onerous and lengthy terms and conditions, policies that litter the web. Many companies bury their data collection controls deep within their websites. Even if consumers can find them, their choices most likely don't apply to a company's subsidiaries or its affiliates. Because of how personal data is shared, there could be thousands or hundreds of thousands of companies that have data on you, according to Stacy Gray, who is senior consultant at the nonprofit company Future of Privacy Forum. Users typically do not change their default settings, even when it means their data is being collected. Well, this is understandable then, why companies want to preserve the status quo. Culling and distributing personally identifiable data is how web users are served up the lucrative ads that can seem distressingly relevant. However, consumers' data is now so widely dispersed that security breaches can sweep up information about people who've never even visited certain websites. It should not be the role of the consumers to make marketers' jobs easier. Furthermore, there's evidence that such highly targeted advertising isn't really necessary to support the free web. as technology companies who are against opting in provisions often argue. Congress has shown a willingness to control the power of the largest technology companies, which amassed a record profit amid the pandemic. Even as unemployment rates soared and cities placed limits on local commerce for months at a time, without comprehensive federal privacy legislation, regulation of the web has been left to states and to companies. That has led to a confusing jumble of laws and policies, which can be difficult for companies to comply with and for our consumers to understand, and which privacy advocates say end up being far too business friendly. If you remember Major League Baseball back into the 50s and the 40s, and even earlier perhaps for a few of you, do you remember what the outfielders used to do at the end of an inning as they ran into the dugout as teams changed sides? What did the outfielders do? For many years, it appeared as though outfielders abandoned their gloves at the end of the inning. They tossed them down, letting the gloves remain where they landed, and didn't retrieve them until they returned to their defensive positions the next inning. Well, why did the National and American Leagues follow this strange ritual? Some said it was bad luck to take your glove with you when you returned to the dugout. Most players admitted they had absolutely no idea whether there was some benefit, real or imagined, if you did this. Well, I remember that back in the 40s, when your host was bat boy for the Detroit Tiger visiting teams, that this practice was followed. And I often wondered why the ball players did this. And of course, the practice then was carried on by amateurs, kids playing ball on sandlots. You'd see them dropping their gloves because they wanted to copy what their heroes were doing. But there was no really logical purpose behind it, at least none that I could find. And so the practice was discontinued in 1954. So those of you who are old enough to have seen what I've been describing will remember that fondly. They always used to drop their gloves and go into the dugout. Is beef past its prime? Well, the New York Times a few weeks ago had an article about this. It was written by Frank Bruni. And Frank said, "I like my patties thin, and then I like them thick. there was this Cheddar period, followed by the Roquefort interregnum. Sesame seed buns gave way to English muffins as ketchup traded places with special sauce, or even, God help me, guacamole, which really was overkill. But no matter the cradle or the condiment, the hamburger was with me for the long haul. I was sure of that. Until now. And then he goes on to say, a few days ago, I tripped across news that McDonald's was testing a vegetable-based patty coming soon to a griddle near you. The McPlant Burger, they're calling it. A McOxymoron, if I've ever heard one. And McDonald's is late to the game because Burger King has been selling a meatless Impossible Whopper since 2019. Dunkin' has been serving a Beyond Sausage breakfast sandwich for nearly as long. But meanwhile, Bill Gates has been telling anyone who would sit still long enough to listen about his investment in a pretty amazing startup that uses a protein made from especially hardy fungus for meatless patties, meatless balls, and vegan versions of various dairy products. On 60 Minutes, Gates ate yogurt made by the startup Nature's Find with Anderson Cooper, and he raved, "Oh, this is good. This is the future. Not a meatless one, not anytime soon, but one with less meat. I'm now sure of that. It's the inevitable consequence of alarm over climate change, in which livestock farming contributes significantly. It's the moral of the McPlant. It's also the takeaway from Nature's Find, whose story is not just a parable of innovation and imagination, but it's also a glimpse into the ever more muscular push for alternative protein sources and the fleetingly growing market for them. In the relatively brief span of time since Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat introduced their now ubiquitous burger as an alternative, a meatless gold rush has been born. Private investments, public investment, researchers working in this space, starting up companies, announcements from established meat companies launching alternative protein initiatives. All of these were essentially flat until about 4 or 5 years ago. And then we saw a classic change. One track represented by Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat focuses on the refinement of plant-based products that get better and better at providing the pleasures of meat. Agriculture and its strains on Mother Earth remain central. That's not so with the track of what is called cultivated meats, or meat essentially grown from the stem cells of animals. For now, though, this is an expensive and uncertain proposition. And so I thought I'd bring this up before we close today. You may have already tried the meat substitutes and have formed an opinion about whether or not you're going to to go beefless or not. But I, for one, still like the Whopper and the Big Mac. But to each his own. And now, my friends, it's time for us to lock up the store for the day, as they say. This is Dan Dillman asking you to be safe. Take care of yourself. Wear your masks, maybe two if possible. Observe social distances when necessary. You have a good day, my friends. And tune in to a little of this, a little of that. I like to have you around, and I'll be waiting for you the next time we're here in about a week or so. Until then, good day, and take care.